Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S Y because I love you, R E double T. Welcome back to Coast AM. Quick story. I mentioned R. Gary Patterson's passing off the top of the show. What I didn't mention, and I have talked about this on my weekly syndicated show, The Conspiracy Show, I talked about it with my colleague here at Coast, Dave Schrader. I even reached out to paranormal investigator Rosemary Ellen Guiley to figure out what happened. So here's the deal. Gary and I talked and emailed every week. And in the last 6 months, we talked or Skyped probably twice a week. We were working on a project together, and it looked like it might finally get off the ground after about 2 years of struggle. So Gary died Friday, May the 26th, and we had talked Thursday night before he passed, and I thought, before I found out about his passing, I thought I was sure we had talked that Friday night. So Saturday morning, I wake up, get my coffee, and I get a Facebook message from Dave Schrader letting me know that Gary had died Friday night. And my immediate reaction was to message back and say, that is nonsense. I talked to Gary last night. Then the next thing I did was I called Gary on his cell phone and I left a message. I said, Gary, I'm getting some disturbing news here from Coast to Coast. Are you okay? Please call me. Again, I was so certain I had talked to him Friday night. So he did, in fact, call me Thursday night to tell me about a conference call meeting we'd been working towards, and he told me it was going to take place on the following Monday. Then I was sure again that he called me Friday night to tell me that Monday was, of course, Memorial Day, so the meeting was being moved to Wednesday. Then I checked my iPhone, and I clicked on recent calls. There was Gary's call from Thursday night, but no calls registered for Friday. I didn't have any incoming calls, and I didn't have any outgoing calls. So then I thought, okay, I've misremembered. We didn't talk Friday, just Thursday. But it didn't feel right. I was so certain we talked Friday night. Then I asked my lovely bride, the mighty Aphrodite, I said, was I talking to anybody Friday night? And she said immediately, yes. She said, you walked right through the kitchen with the phone to your ear and you were talking to somebody, and I forgot to ask you who you were talking to, and you never mentioned it. Then I started remembering things that Gary had said in our last conversation. And he said a couple of things that now began to strike me as odd. I remember wishing him a happy Memorial Day weekend, and I asked him, are you going to have a barbecue, which is kind of traditional. And then he stated rather emphatically, no, he said, no, there will be no barbecue. I thought, okay, I'll just leave that one alone. And then he said two things before hanging up. He said, Richard, you are one cool dad. And Richard, you and I, we're a big deal. Now, I don't mention that part for the purpose of self-aggrandizement. I just thought it was a nice thing for him to say. But why did he say it then and there? So, maybe I misremembered the whole thing. That's quite likely. Or is it possible Gary called me from the other side? Again, I'm inclined to believe it's the former. If he was going to call anyone from the other side, I'm certain it would have been a close family member and not me. But there you go. That's my story. That's the way I remember it or misremember it. We're going to delve further into spirit communication with psychic medium Sloane Bella on the other side. This is Coast to Coast AM. Sloane Bella was born with psychic mediumship abilities, and by the age of 4, she learned to articulate nightly visits by otherworldly beings, aliens, and the spirits of those people who had crossed over. These communications went on throughout her childhood. This was how she began to develop her ability to act as a conduit and to speak the different frequencies that exist around us. Sloane was a homeless teenager and began her career on the streets in her hometown of Toronto, Canada, working with missing and exploited children. One of the most unusual connections was her mediumship communication with the late Jimi Hendrix, who guided her and aided her working on the streets of Toronto and Hollywood as a street psychic with intuitive guidance to runaway and sexually exploited children. By the age of 17, Sloan was established as a professional psychic medium. Sloan Bella, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm good, Richard. I'm so excited to be on your show, and a fellow Canadian you are. So I'm really excited.
Well, it's all home week, and we're delighted to have you here. But admittedly, I mean, your time in Toronto was not particularly a happy one, I'm guessing. What led you to living on the streets?
Well, I'm assuming, just from knowing who I am, I'm rebellious. So what happened was, when you're a psychic child and you are born into a family, or in my case, adopted into a family where you're not understood, and you could be not understood for any reason, not just psychic. But I used to get in a lot of trouble for things that I would say that would come out of me from an intuitive perspective, as opposed to what I was supposed to say. And when I mentioned the aliens growing up, I didn't know they were aliens. I described these people that used to visit me at night, and my family thought I was completely nuts. It caused a lot of dissension in my home, and it was just every day I was getting in trouble for speaking and what I was seeing and what I was saying. So I just decided to leave. And actually, I kind of heard a voice in my head that said, it's okay, you can go now. So I just left. I just up and left one day. And that was what led me out the door. And I wasn't really nervous about it. I just took one knapsack, two shirts, a warm shirt, some boots, a pair of running shoes, and out the door I went. And that was the end of it. I just was like, okay, going to explore the world. So I really believe it was because I saw things differently, and my family was more traditional or conservative, I guess you could say.
Right. And so this was when you were what, 14?
I remember the day. It was exactly 3 months after I turned 14. I turned 14 in August, and I left before Thanksgiving. I mean, American Thanksgiving, not Canadian Thanksgiving. I have to clarify that because...
And there was no looking back. There was no reconciliation with your adopted family, or was there?
Well, I spoke to them, but I never moved back in my home, no. And I just continued. Of course, you know, the first year I was what you call on the run. I was, you know, probably like a stray cat running down the street, or a dog. But I was on the run, and I would get into some trouble. But eventually, I kept moving from town to town, city to city, and actually crossed the border several times and lived my life that way. And I never was really at a loss. I was able to read people, but I got very enmeshed in, you could say, the street world with other people that don't go to 9-to-5 jobs, the strippers, the gamblers, everybody that's kind of in the nightlife. And they used to come to me for readings. Now, granted, I didn't charge a lot of money at that time. I would do things like, it's terrible to say, but trade a reading 15 minutes for a pack of cigarettes, because you know how expensive they were in Canada. And no, I don't smoke anymore, but I would do that. Or I would trade with a hairdresser for, you know, do my roots, I'll give you a reading kind of thing. So I got away by bartering, actually, throughout my teen years quite a lot. And it was a good thing. It was a really good skill to have, because those people want to know if they're going to be safe on the streets, especially working girls, working guys. They want to know if, when they go out at night and they get into someone's car, are they going to be safe? I also had a lot of people that would ask me questions like, if I go down to the racetrack, am I going to win? I got a lot of those questions. So that was mainly my work back then, and helping kids understand, other kids like myself, understand that I found out really early on that when you leave home young, there's a association, negative judgment put on you. And so I learned to work with people about what their soul wanted them to do, not what society said. And I learned that really young. So it was an interesting lesson for me, because I struggled with the same issues, but I was able to see and help other people through those issues, and eventually myself behind them. But it was
Sloan Bella is with us, and she's a psychic medium, and we're talking about her time on the streets, both in Toronto and then later, I guess, in Hollywood. So aside from using your psychic abilities sort of in a barter system just to survive, did it also serve you in terms of reading people, staying out of dangerous situations? Because, you know, a 14-year-old on the streets of any big city, I mean, you're in a very obviously, needless to say, a vulnerable situation.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not sure I was the brightest bulb in the bunch at the time, because I tended to see people from the perspective of they will eventually, the soul perspective, they are good. So I would see them from the potential of the soul. But where it was really interesting is for me, when I would meet somebody that I would have dinner with or want to go out on a date with, I could see very clearly, and I believe to me the drugs open people up, but I could see very clearly the intention of their thinking and if it was corrupted. And by corrupted, I don't mean just being human. I mean, if they were really involved into something negative, I could feel that right away. So I would repel against it. I would not stay with it. That's not to say that I avoided every pitfall of being a kid on the street, but I didn't get murdered and I didn't get kidnapped. And, you know, there was nothing along those lines that happened to me when I was very young. So I was able to guide myself that way. And I was very cautious about it. So for me, it was a very physical sensation. So if I would walk up to you and let's say you said hi to me, you know, in a grocery store and I would walk up to you, I could feel if you were going to, you would radiate negative. So I would kind of back up from you. So I didn't let people get physically too close to me if I didn't like the way their energy felt. It's kind of like putting on a prickly sweater. They would be prickly to my energy. I would feel prickly, like a wool sweater on your skin without a shirt under it. That's how it felt to me. So I would kind of back away from them. And I believe that was an, you know, clairsentient or a way to feel the energy of the other person. And it would hit me straight up. So I would avoid those people like the plague, politely so at the time, or maybe even not politely, but I would back away from it. There was a lot of physical sensations with me when I would walk by people, and I would feel uncomfortable if they were not having the best intention towards me. And if they were basically an okay human being, then these things didn't happen. So it was a very good guide. And I noticed a lot of street kids, and I'm talking about, you know, teen prostitutes on the street. I noticed a lot of them had this intuitive ability, heightened intuitive ability, because they had to stay safe while they were doing this. This was part of their soul development for whatever reason, and they had to learn how to stay safe. And many of them described very similar things that I described growing up. They were very in tune with whose car to get into. And this was interesting. I talked to a young kid once, a couple years older than me, and he had refused to get into somebody's car, and his friend had gotten into the car, and that person had ended up being killed by the person he got into the car with. This kid spoke about it all the time and just couldn't believe how he nearly missed getting into that car. But he listened to his instinct. That's the important thing, is to listen to your instinct, no matter how ridiculous it seems at the time or how other people try to talk you out of listening to it. So these kids have a heightened sense of awareness just by proximity of their situation.
Sure, sure. The self-preservation is amplified, obviously, in a situation like that. But you would, I'm guessing, or maybe not, but I'm guessing you would draw a distinction, though, between that heightened sense of awareness and the gift that you have, which is the psychic ability. Or is there a difference?
Well, I believe those kids, I call it living a psychic life. So when somebody experiences a lot of what we consider either trauma or tragedy or crazy stuff happening in their childhood all the way through their life, like just crazy things that most people go, oh my gosh, I can't believe that happened. I consider that a psychic life. So there's certain people that are born, I believe we all have intuition, but the calling to do the work is one thing, because you are born psychic and you're born a medium. Those are things that can't be taught. You can go to classes and elevate it, or learn how to access it, but you're born with the ability. Like you're born with a certain skin color, period. I believe psychic ability and mediumship is the same thing. The veil is off. You're born that way. Now, what you do with it, people always say, no, I can teach you to do it. Not really unless you have it innate. For example, and I'll give you an example of this. I always like the idea of being a singer. I can't sing to save my life. You give me $1 million and I'm still not going to be able to sing. I could take classes and probably get a certificate and be good or somewhat functional at singing, but I'm never going to be a channeled singer, like some of those beautiful voices, like Celine Dion, another Canadian. I mean, you know, you're never going to get that because she's born with that. That came through her. That right. is what she's supposed to do. I believe the same thing with people who do this work, but those kids on the street were living what I call a psychic life. It opens them up to the idea of soul growth, not just what we see on the mundane physical plane of the earth, which is 9 to 5, make money, get married, have a family, do this, do that, you know, go to church on right. Sunday, have picnics and Christmas. This is a psychic life, so the soul is what's being aspected in the life, and that's how I see these kids. My psychic ability, I mean, I believe, if I'm correct, from family members who called me quite odd when I was little. I don't remember being called odd, but as I grew up, some of my aunts and uncles would tell me you were very odd, strange little child. But I can remember being, I mean, the first time my parents sent me to, I guess you could say, a shrink, a kid shrink or whatever, because of the things I said that were psychic and actually not crazy, I was about 2.5. They thought there was something not right with me. But again, I was adopted, so they probably were not used to the energy in their family, meaning it wasn't, and nobody else in that family had it, because it wasn't of that lineage. I also sure. believe that psychic ability is a genetic trait handed down.
Interesting. And was there ever a time, Sloan, when, I mean, here you are, you end up on the street. Well, it was your decision, but did mm-hmm. did you ever curse this gift, this ability, and say, you know, because, and blamed it for your station in life now? Now you're on the street, and if you hadn't blurted out about, you know, talking about communicating with aliens, or if you hadn't been considered the odd little child, if you had maybe said nothing, you would not have been on the street. Did you ever, were you ever in that situation?
That's a good question, because the way that I thought about that, actually, it didn't hit me at the time. I was so happy to be free. I have this thing with being free, and I'm an avid runner, but to me, which is also a form of freedom, but for me to be able to live the way that I felt I wanted to, that was actually exciting. I was not frightened. I perhaps was lonely at times when other people were doing things like going to prom or, you know, finishing high school, those kinds of things. But I was never like angry about that. I was actually always climbing forward. So I was listening to my voice and I knew I would be okay. So there was an innate sense of security for some reason. And I don't know why, but there was. It wasn't until I had my own kids and I thought, God, you know, growing up in a family and then being cut out of the family, you lose a lot in that sense, so to speak. So it wasn't until I had my own kids that I recognized perhaps what was missing. But I still haven't regretted it. I'm actually, you know, it is the way that it is. So I don't look back. I go in the moment. I'm not that kid anymore. I'm this person. So I kind of live exactly in the moment, and I always have. I'm not really a planner. I just listen and, you know, go forward with where I feel I should be at the time. And it, as you know, when you have little small children in diapers, that's where fear might come in, because you're responsible for another person. So that would be the only time that I considered, like, well, if I'd have stayed at home, I might have not have, you know, been disinherited. I might not have been shunned from the family. Maybe things would be different, but it's not really hindered me. It's made me very authentic in who I am. And I'm actually, I won't apologize for it. You know, I mean,
no, nor should you, nor should you.
Yeah. It's just who I am. And it's actually what I came to realize, regardless of the path that a person takes, even if you're in, let's say you end up in jail and you're like, oh my God, I shouldn't have done what that person said. Look where I am. I'm spending, you know, this time, if I'd have shut my mouth. No, your soul actually led you to that place for a reason. I've really come to understand that. So I don't have regret in that sense. And keep in mind that, you know, and I do believe in reincarnation, but in another life, if there's something I've missed out in this life, I can always agree to come back and live the kind of life that, quote, I feel I missed out on. Although I feel like it's a very unique experience and I've enjoyed it. There hasn't really been anything I've looked back on. And I really wasn't afraid when I was younger. Perhaps I was too stupid to be afraid, but I just wasn't. You know, spiders frighten me more.
Sloan Bell is with a psychic medium. And when we come back, we're heading into a break here shortly. But when we come back, I want to find out when you began to communicate with the spirit of the late, great James Marshall Hendricks.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
We'll talk about how, I guess, in some respects, he guided your work, working with other street children. It's a fascinating chapter in the life of Sloan Bella. And we'll do that on the other side. Coming back with, going into the break, rather, with Ike and Tina Turner. Sugar, sugar. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll get back to our conversation with Sloan Bella, psychic medium, in just a few moments. And this is an incredible story, how while on the streets, she was in communication, she believes, with the spirit of the late Jimi Hendrix. Wildlife authorities have been investigating the recent sighting of an ape-like creature in California. Jake Gardner had been walking along a woodland hiking trail in the La Crescenta foothills last week when he encountered a peculiar uneasiness and feeling that something was watching him. Taking out his cell phone, he recorded footage of the surrounding area in the hope of picking up something. And to his surprise, when he watched the video back afterwards, he noticed what appeared to be a large ape swinging through the trees above. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has since been investigating the sighting, and they say it's a pretty good possibility it's some kind of ape. According to a spokesman, he said, these animals are incredibly strong and they can very easily kill or seriously injure a person because if it turns out to be an ape, this animal is scared, hungry, and out of its element. You can read more on this story in the news section where our webmaster tonight, Sean Latasor, has posted this story at coasttocoastam.com. Sloan Bella and the ghost of Jimi Hendrix when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, Talk Radio AM 640. Sloan Bella, psychic medium on the line from Los Angeles. Sloan, you're on the streets in Toronto. You're a young woman, a teenager, and at some point you are in communication with the spirit, you believe, of Jimi Hendrix. How did that happen?
Oh my gosh, that was really interesting. Well, he first started coming into my space, and let me just describe how I picked him up. I saw images of him in my mind, almost like I would see clips and snippets, little vignettes of a movie scene when you're clicking through something like, you know, when they have coming attraction trailers, that's almost what it looks like. And I would get little nuances of this man's face. This was before I ran away, actually. I started to see this man. And what's interesting is I'm a huge fan now of Jimi Hendrix. At the time that I saw him, and this is going to sound really strange, it might even really age me a lot, but I was completely obsessed with the Bay City Rollers. I don't know if anybody remembers that band, but you're laughing.
You're forgiven.
I know. Whatever. Good for them. I was about maybe 12 and a half at the time. And I was a fan of Queen. Okay, that's better. That brings my core.
All right. You've
up,
gained your street cred back, Sloan. You've gained
yeah,
it back.
Got it back. But Jimi Hendrix, I was not actually listening to that music at the time. It wasn't until I was a later teenager and finally figured out who he was. But he would come to me. And within weeks of me running away, I would hear chatter in my head. And it was interesting because it was about this, God, how can I describe it? I would see musical notes and almost as if somebody was writing on paper musical information. Now, I am not musical, as I've stated. But I felt from the other side, and I didn't know who he was. I just knew what he looked like, and I could describe him, okay? He was vibrant color, larger than life. And he used to come through, and every time I was about to do something bad, it was really interesting, and I won't get into how bad I was trying to be at the time, but he used to say I was doing something not in my best interest. I'll call it an apparition, for lack of a better word. It's like I could reach out and touch him, but it was more watery and not quite as solid as things that we can touch in front of us. And I would see that, and I would become distracted by what he was doing, and he would play music. And I'm not, like, really not joking when I say that. It was music I hadn't heard, and it led me to believe that he was actually composing a lot of music at the time of his death that has never been released and wasn't released. And I actually feel like somebody has taken those original works of his and done something with them. I don't know what they've done with them, but at the time it was like he was trying to complete his life, which I began to understand that he had been taken out of his life he would describe things to me, and this is putting thoughts in my head. It's like they impress in your mind. I didn't hear him speak as if, like, I'm talking to you and I can hear you, but I would get impressions that were coming from him. And he was very actually connected to the street kids. He was, I almost feel like he was one himself, and I don't know this to be true because I don't think I've read that anywhere, but it's like he understood what I was going through. And so I had this imaginary friend that had vibrant colored clothing on and would play music in my mind for me. And I felt like I had somebody watching out for me, and he completely understood who I was. And again, I have no idea who this man is. I just think it's another person that I've picked up the energy of them. But as I continued to communicate with him, and he would come to me in dreams, and he disappeared. You know, I was probably in my early 20s when I didn't pick this up again until actually a couple of months ago. And he came to me in a dream, or I felt like he came to me in a dream, or I dreamt about him, but it was very vivid and alive. And I got the impression that at the point that he died, there were other people around him in his surroundings. I know they said it was, I want to say an alcohol overdose. I don't even know if you call that an overdose, but I want
to say, I mean, there's some speculation that he had wine poured down his throat. He was not apparently a fan of red wine, and they found red wine in his lungs by some accounts. He almost drowned in wine.
I feel like somebody was there and they stepped away from him when he was in medical distress. And I got that as a teenager. He was very strong about almost trying to complete his work. It was like, and this is for no reason, because I had no musical ability. I keep saying that. Can't sing, can't write, never written music, don't ever claim to. But it was like he was trying to write music to make me pass it on. So from the other side, he hadn't completed that work creatively. And it was driving passion of his soul. I did get that. I you know, obviously figured out he was a musician. I did not know he was famous. For all I knew, was that kind of kid. He was just somebody who wanted to be a musician who'd passed away too soon. So, you know, it wasn't until later on I was like, holy, you know what, look at who I've been talking to. And it was comforting, and yet it was really kind of amusing to me because I was like, why would you come to me? But see, here's what I understood from him at that time, and this is a valuable lesson I learned. I can understand why my family members would come to me, okay? So when certain people pass, like my grandmother, I get why they come to me, because I know them, right, in life, or friends or whatever. But I couldn't figure out why this person came to me. And what he described to me was, and I'll use the analogy of driving to Las Vegas. If you've ever, and he didn't put it in those terms, but if you've ever driven to Las Vegas in the middle of the night trying to get there so you can gamble all day.
I have. Well, not to gamble, but I have.
Yes. Well, I was going for the buffets, but whatever. Anyway,
wink, wink, sure.
Yeah, you know, wink, wink. Yeah, exactly. But when you're driving really quickly down the freeway, and let's say your car runs out of gas or you blow a tire, what are you looking for? You're looking for a light off the road, a gas station, but preferably somebody's house with a light on. So when I was communicating with Jimi Hendrix and wondered who he was, it was him telling me, I'll call it telepathically, letting me know that because my door was open, he could see the light coming from my crown chakra. He was trying to communicate with everybody and anybody who could pick him up so that he could finish his music. That's actually what it boiled down to. And back then, I actually knew that he was not alone at the moment that he died. So it wasn't like he was alone in his house and, you know, accidentally slipped into a coma or drowning or, you know, whatever from the drugs and alcohol. It wasn't like that at all, actually. He was about to come, my understanding of it as a kid and still now, was that he was about to come out with new versions of creative music. Somebody took those and they've never released them, but they consumed them. So this was a jealousy thing, and it had to do with the fact that he was about to even hit a higher note on his career. So I feel like he was about to burst open. When he passed over, he was not at peace with that. I probably started communicating with him maybe 10 or so years after he passed, because I was a kid. I was born in the mid-60s. I believe he passed in the early 70s. And so it would have been the late 70s, early 80s that I was communicating with him. He was still not settled at that point. He wasn't like in pain or anything. He was trying to be heard. He wanted to communicate, and it was a soul drive even on the other side.
Is that communication two-way? Were you able to ask questions of him and get replies?
Yeah, in my head, yes. Because I kept saying, who are you? And he would say, Jimmy. And I'm like, okay, so you're Jimmy, that's cool. And I would tell my little friends, I say little friends, younger friends at the time that I was hanging out with, you know, when we'd go to clubs and this kind of thing in Toronto, down from Young and Bluers, you know, when we go down on these clubs and we'd listen to the bands, it wasn't until there was a Jimi Hendrix knockoff band or tribute band, I guess you call them, that I realized who I'd been talking to. And I was probably almost 15, 16 at that time. And I was like, oh my God, that's the guy I've been talking to. That's my friend. And it was really funny because people would just look at you like, yeah, okay, sure. You know, are you drugged? Are you medicated? What's the problem? But it was interesting. I was not aware of who he was. Like when I tell you that, I was in this whole other mindset where I wasn't necessarily doing that. And then when I got into the music scene at that time and recognized people who were pretending to be him or playing tribute to him, I guess is a better word. It was like, oh my goodness. But yeah, I got the impression he wasn't finished with his work. That's what was said over and over. He also had an extremely soft spot for kids that didn't fit in society, and he was one. I don't know how that was applicable to him in his childhood, but he was definitely somebody who understood the road that I was on.
Right. Well, he had some run-ins with the law prior to joining the Army. I think he stole a car, went for a kind of a joyride, and his choice was he could go to jail or join the Army, so he joined the Army. And that didn't last too long.
That wasn't who he was. That was not who he was. But he was a kind soul, which is really interesting, and he was not of this world. There's some people that are very successful here. He was actually so super sensitive as a person from what I picked up about him, that when he wrote his music, as is the case I've come to find out, now I'll be 51 this year, so in my life, 51 years on the planet, I've come to recognize this, but he truly was working with the other side to create that music. And then while he was on the other side, he was trying to get people on this side to recreate the music. So we're not really dead. We just step into a different realm or a different room. I'll call it a different room behind the veil. He stepped into a different dimension, but he was still creating music, and it was the passion of his soul. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised if when he comes back into another life, he's still doing that, because he was not happy about not being able to complete that. That I do know.
And right. It's interesting you mentioned – sorry, go ahead. Continue.
No, I was saying he was very helpful to, like, street kids. He was
right.
He was smart, he was worldly, and he had compassion for the kid that was thrown out of the house for whatever reason, beat up at home, abused at home, neglected at home, you know, mocked at home, whatever it was. He was 100% on their side. He preferred that group. So if you were a bit of an oddball, he was in that realm with you. Even though when we look at him now, and I look at him, he was anything but an oddball. He was an amazing, unique, creative genius, way, way ahead of his time.
I mean, you're so right.
The music industry.
You mentioned sort of an otherworldly sort of characteristic to him. And I talked to his it was a percussionist that played with him at Woodstock, Juma Sultan, after after the Jimi Hendrix Experience disbanded. He was in another band, and Juma Sultan performed with him at Woodstock when he played, of course, the Star Spangled Banner. And Juma described Hendrix's his composing abilities and his playing abilities. He called it the music of the spheres, which I thought was very interesting. It just kind of speaks to that otherworldliness.
Big time, because when he is in the other world, as he is currently, I don't believe he's been reincarnated back, because probably 4.5 months ago, for some reason, I was talking to him all night in a dream in my head. And I actually haven't researched this, but I got the impression his life was about to become relevant again. It's always relevant, but I mean, I got the impression something was going to come out about him again. And it may, in the next 2 years, there may be like another like focus on him as a musician for some reason, or something he created coming out. But I got that impression, because it's like he wanted me to know that he was still here and that I would be hearing about him. And there were other street kids that I've talked to as I've grown up who also he visited. So I wasn't the only one. He was quite popular back then, and he was trying to get people to write his music down and put it out there for him because he needed it to be out there. And when I look back on it now, and as I'm talking to you right at the second, I get the distinct impression that he didn't want whoever stole the work, and I'm going to use the word stole, whoever stole his work to publish it before he got a chance to. Like, that's something that really bothered him. I can tell you that when he passed, it was out of jealousy and somebody took off with that creation. And I think he was trying to get us all who could hear him or could focus on him to bring that about and create it. Like, I just remember him trying to teach me how to write music from the other side. And I would actually start to write musical notes that I had no idea what I was doing. I was like, I don't even understand this. Like, what is this? You know, Japanese, Chinese, what is it?
Right. Are you able, Sloan, are you able to employ, do you ever employ things like automatic writing to communicate with spirits?
Oh, I have, yes, especially when I was younger. And by younger, I mean in first and second and third grade, I was quite a writer at that time. Since computers have come into my life, I'm probably a very lazy writer. But for example, if you called me and said, you know, so-and-so has a missing kid, for, and this is the time I use it. And what I do is I do a thing called moving meditation. So in the morning, I actually focus on physically exerting my energy so that I can get the information rather than worrying about the laundry, the dishes, my kids, you know, this kind of thing. And if you had a question for me, I would write down your question, like, you know, can you help me find Sarah, for example? And I would write that down as I'm running, and I'm by myself. I'm not in a gym. I'm not in a running track. As I'm doing that, I'm repeating that over and over in my head. And then I'm physically exhausting myself to see what information I can get to come through. And when I get back to the car, I usually have a pen and paper, and I will start writing the information I've got so that when I talk to you on the phone or you come to visit me or however it works, I'm able to give you the information I got. So unbiasedly, without thinking about anything. So that's when I use automatic writing. It's actually an extremely good tool because it's not me. But I'm not really connected to the information I give. Like, if I tell you something and you tell me I'm crazy, that's not my issue. I'm just giving you knowledge, like information, and what you do with it is your business. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. There's no ego attached to it because I'm like a phone line. So it's
sure.
Not about me and whether I think, you know, it's not even, I have no judgment when I'm reading.
That's right. You're the conduit. That's all.
Yes, that's it. I'm a telephone line.
So if you, are you able to, for example, Sloan, are you able to pose questions to someone like Jimi Hendrix and perhaps get a reply, either an image or hear a voice or a reply through automatic writing?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, you can do that. It might not come right when I ask it, because sometimes spirits can be stubborn. He's not a stubborn one, by the way, but they can. Let's say I've never gotten Elvis Presley. No matter what I do, I cannot get Elvis Presley. And apparently,
because he's upstairs at Graceland, Sloan. He's still with us.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, I can't get him. You're right. And people would say he's in Taco Bell. He's here. He's there. I'm like, look, I can't pick him up. But they're stubborn souls. Some souls leave this planet and they don't want anything to do with it. They want nothing to do with it. And they're out of here. They don't care who's here. They know they'll see them eventually. They have trust and confidence in that, and they're okay with the journey. Those are the exploratory ones that like to go off. It's only when something has happened that they either have a desire line and they haven't completed something and they feel a need to, or there's been, you know, like the movie Ghost. I love the movie Ghost with Whoopi Goldberg, Patrick Swayze. It's such an excellent articulation of a soul that's taken out of its life too soon and needs to correct that for it to move on. I know it's a comedy and I know it's all tongue in cheek, but it's actually extremely accurate if you can put all of the, you know, creative license behind and actually look at how Patrick Swayze's character tries to get people to hear it.
Right. So minus the Potter's wheel. Minus the Potter's wheel.
Yeah.
I want to take
a good scene.
We're going to – no, it's a wonderful movie, absolutely. We're heading into a break, but I'm wondering if I could just take a bit of a flyer here and ask if between now and – I don't know if you'll get a response. You don't know if you'll get a response, but I'm curious because as someone who has, you know, looked into Jimi Hendrix's his life, his death – there's some speculation. I mean, his road manager at the time, Tappy Wright, is very certain that Jimi Hendrix was murdered. And
yeah, I feel like he was not taken care of at the point when he was in medical distress. That I've gotten very clearly. There was no way that whoever was in, it's like they stepped away from the body. We've seen it in movies where you'll see a character overdosing and somebody steps away. It was in Breaking Bad with the girlfriend of what's his name when she was having the heroin overdose in the bed. If you
right.
ever watched that show,
well,
and
you know, yes,
yeah, they walked away. Bryan Cranston's character walked away.
Well, it's funny you should mention that because Monica Daneman, his girlfriend at the time, was with him in London when he passed, and she told authorities she walked away. She left the building to get a pack of smokes around the corner. So there was no one there when the ambulance attendants arrived.
Yeah, that's interesting. There was also a male person there. I'm getting that right now as you're asking. I know you're asking after the break.
That would be Eric Burden of the Animals. Listen, we'll take a timeout. Here's Tom Waits taking us into the break in the neighborhood back with Sloan Bella on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us.